From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Mad Max, the last law in a world gone out of control.
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
As you can hear, things didn't get any better for Mad Max in the 36 years between the first film and the latest, Fury Road, which is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Today, the director, George Miller, tells us about making his Mad Max films and taking inspiration from the car culture of rural Australia.
The car was the thing. I mean, like a lot of rural people, people were driving when they were kids already. And then I had an education in big city hospitals, and I saw the other side of it as well, the chaos of the vehicles.
And we'll hear a remembrance of singer, songwriter, and band leader Dan Hicks. He died Saturday at age 74. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest today, Australian filmmaker George Miller, directed one of the movies nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. Here's a typical scene. The film is Mad Max Fury Road, and calling it a nonstop action film probably understates the case. Richard Brody of The New Yorker said it brings an eyeball-scorching, cornea-melting, socket-shattering intensity. It's earned 10 Oscar nominations, including Best Director. Fury Road revives the Mad Max series directed by Miller in the 70s and 80s, all starring Mel Gibson. The new film stars Tom Hardy as Max, along with Charlize Theron as Furiosa, this film's road warrior. Miller is known for incredibly realistic action sequences, but his work has a softer side, too. He wrote and produced the film Babe, about a pig who becomes a master sheepherder. Miller also wrote and directed the sequel, Babe, Pig in the City, and the animated films Happy Feet and Happy Feet 2. At age 70, Miller has just been named jury president of this year's Cannes Film Festival. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Mad Max Fury Road was shot in Namibia and is set in a post-apocalyptic desert world where Charlize Theron's character takes to the road in a massive Mack truck-like vehicle called a war rig to escape an evil warlord named Immortant Joe. She's also liberating Joe's five young wives. They meet up with Max and are chased through the desert by an armada of vehicles with bizarre armor and weapons. Here's Tom Hardy's opening voiceover from Mad Max Fury Road.
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
Why are you hurting these people?
It's the oil, stupid.
Oil wars.
We are killing for gasoline.
The world is actually running out of water.
Now there's the water wars.
Once, I was a cop. A road warrior searching for a righteous cause.
Point.
Mankind has gone rogue,
terrorizing itself.
The earth is sour.
Our bones are poisoned.
We have become half-life.
As the world fell, each of us in our own way was broken. It was hard to know who was more crazy. Me, or everyone else.
And the story begins. George Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. Great to have you. There aren't a lot of quiet moments in this film. We hear Tom Hardy as Max talking there. This is a wild ride of war on wheels, and the vehicles are real, shooting all kinds of weapons, people leaping from one to another, huge cars and trucks and other kinds of vehicles smashing into each other and rolling over at various speeds. You didn't use a lot of computer-generated graphics here, right? Why did you want to actually have these vehicles in the action?
Well, it's a film in which we don't defy the laws of physics. It's real people in a real desert. There's no men in capes flying around or space vehicles and so on. So it wouldn't make a lot of sense to shoot it all digitally, or a large part of it, because it would lose a lot of it authenticity, and it's very, very difficult, despite the amazing advances in 15 to 20 years of the digital world in filmmaking. It's still very difficult to make something feel really authentic. So we chose to do it old school, and that means going out to a remote location with endless desert and have real vehicles and human beings in that landscape and so on.
You know, again and again, you'll see a vehicle of some kind that's chasing a big truck and smashing into the truck, and the truck will wheel over and try and knock the vehicle off the road. These are real vehicles, real people in them. How do you manage that safely?
with a lot of preparation, with a film like this, where it's a long shoot, it's 120 days out there, every day is a big stunt day. So you have to be almost fanatical about preparation and safety. Otherwise, things could go horribly wrong. And so everything was very well rehearsed, very well prepared. And we had a wonderful stunt crew and rigging crew and effects crew out there. And it got to the point where, with proper preparation, you're able to sort of get the actors who are, all of them, pretty physical, athletic people in a lot of the shots. When there's a moment when you see Max hanging upside down between the wheels of this war rig, inches off the ground.
While it's moving, right?
While it's moving, it's going fairly fast. Well, that's Tom Hardy there. But he has two very, very secure harnesses supporting him. And also, nowadays you can erase them very easily, whereas in the past you couldn't.
You said you can erase them. And that's,
you can erase the harnesses.
That's where the computer graphics comes in, I guess.
And that's where it comes in. Plus, there's a lot of work creating or enhancing the landscapes. Because the film itself plays out more or less in real time over 3 days and two nights, we're also able to get a consistency in the sky and in the shadows and the landscape. So, even though most of it is real world, virtually every shot has CG in it in some way.
So the sky would be colored, or the landscape would be colored, but the cars are really crashing into each other.
Yes. You're also able to raise your previous takes. I used to watch movies when I was younger, and you'd know how many takes people did by the number of skid marks on the road. So we can now erase take 1, 2, and 3 and simply have the skid marks of take 4.
There's a series of wild and violent chases that happen in this movie, and you see one of the weapons that is used by these sort of dune buggy-like vehicles that are chasing this big truck is you'll see these poles, like 30 feet high, extending from these little chasing vehicles, and men on them, which, if I'm describing this properly, the poles bend, and then kind of like a pendulum, they swing the guy on top of the pole over to either attack the truck or jump onto it. This is an amazing thing to witness, and it was real, right? Tell us where this idea came from.
Well, in a chase story like this, you're always looking for something that is new. Now, in the same way that pirates board ships and so on, we had these things called polecats, which is vehicles with a wide wheelbase and these pendulum-like poles going quite a ways up into the air, and men on top of them swinging, and as they come over the top of this war rig, they can jump down on top of it. Now, I had seen some street performers with fixed poles in Australia and in period costumes kind of swaying in the breeze. I thought that almost like those poles that pole vaulters had. And I thought, oh, that would be interesting if we could put them on vehicles. I never imagined that those vehicles would move. I always thought we'd basically shoot them static and then comp them in the usual visual effects way, because I thought the physics of it would be too dangerous. And if something went wrong, it would be catastrophic. So we worked on that, and then because the film was delayed, the stunt crew and the rigging crew basically really, really paid attention to how the physics of it would work, this pendulum-like effect and the flexible pole. And one day I looked across, and coming out of the desert were several of these vehicles with guys up on top of the pole, and they're swinging this way and that, and it was quite something to behold, and it was so safe that we were able to get Tom Hardy on top of one of those, even though It wasn't until he got up on top that he actually said, hey, you do know I'm afraid of heights. And I said, oh, gosh, you, do you have one or two takes in you? And he said, yes, give it a shot. But that is Tom Hardy on top of that pole when he's, you know, Max is in that scene.
The three previous Mad Max films were centered around Max, and he is a big part in this, but in some respects the hero of this is a woman played by Charlize Theron. You want to talk a little bit about her role in this story and what she brought to the part?
Well, the original idea of this film, given that it was to be a chase, was also that what people were in conflict over was to be human. And in this case, five wives escaping a tyrannical warlord, and they needed a road warrior, and it couldn't be a male because that's a different story, and it had to be female. But she needed to be convincing as a warrior, not just someone masquerading as a warrior. So Charlize actually was the only actor I thought about for this role. She's somebody who's got a lot of stature physically and in her spirit, and she's able to... She's pretty uncompromising. She shaved her hair. She said Furiosa would not worry about hair in the heat and the dust, and required quite a bit of immersion from the actors. And Charlize is one of those people who just was able to do that.
You know, at the heart of the story here, you have a very tough and determined woman who is fleeing this despotic warlord, and in doing so, liberating his five wives, essentially women he uses for breeding. Did you think of this as a feminist story when you were writing it?
Not overtly. I was very interested in the character and in the way that the Max stories are told. I mean, basically, they're allegorical stories. They're in the same way, I guess, that the classic Western was that. And Max is a character who gets swept up into this story. He's that sort of wanderer in the wasteland, looking for some sense of meaning in a very stark world. And he gets caught up in their story. And because the MacGuffin, as Hitchcock used to say, the thing that's in conflict, is human and female, it just evolved. The characters go that take you along in the story, and that's sort of the sense that she was somehow... A very, really interesting action hero, female, just arose organically out of the story. The feminist notions of the movie were the same. It was never, the first agenda of the film. It was always story-driven, and the rest followed.
As the story develops, there are these five women who are the captive wives of this warlord, and they're being liberated in this huge vehicle like a big tanker truck. That's at the heart of the chase. The wives, they're young women, don't have a lot of lines, but I read that you invited the feminist playwright and activist Eve Ensler, who wrote The Vagina Monologues, to come to Namibia to speak to those five actors. Is that right?
Yes. Just as the war boys, we call them the half-life war boys, who are basically the cannon fodder for the tyrant who sits on top of the dominance hierarchy. So for the war boys, we had military advisors doing our own version of post-apocalyptic military group, I guess, quite a demented version of that. So it occurred to me that we needed somebody to really help the female actors find a way into their characters and their world, because everybody in this story, except the Immortan Joe, is in some way a commodity. Max himself is a trapped animal who's a blood bag. A Furiosa is a warrior.
That's the Charlize Theron character who's leading it.
Yes. She's a road warrior in the service of the Immortan Joe, who's this despot. And so we needed somebody, and as it happened, I was listening to the radio down in Australia, and Eve, who's extraordinary in the work she does for human rights in Africa, I mean, she goes right into the the dark heart of it. And she just happened to be in the Republic of Congo around about the time we were in Namibia while we were preparing to shoot the movie. And she gave us a week in the middle of a very busy schedule. And she came down and she ran wonderful workshops. A lot of them were quite intimate with just the five girls. And by osmosis, it crept into the movie. I'm quite certain of that.
What crept into the movie?
Just a sense that this story is one that has been fairly constant throughout history, meaning that women and indeed other human beings have been basically the goods and chattels of the powerful. I mean, there was a moment when you see a chastity belt, and it's something that I remember seeing in Venice, you know, quite a brutal-looking chastity belt. And in that one image, you realize that you know that these are some kind of belongings of this powerful man. And that sort of thing happens much more brutally in this real world, unfortunately, apart from what we have in the movies.
George Miller's new film, Mad Max Fury Road, is nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with director George Miller. He directed the Mad Max films. The latest, Mad Max Fury Road, is nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. Well, George Miller, you began your career in a way so many Hollywood folks do, by going to medical school. No. This is interesting. You grew up in, a rural area of Australia, right, and went to medical school. You worked as an emergency room doctor, is that right?
Well, I did my normal rotations through emergency when I worked in a big city hospital. And once I started making films, I would work weekends in emergency and as doing locums. And then during the week, I grappled with learning how to make movies. I tried that for about a few years, and I ended up basically spending all my time making movies and very little time being a doctor. And I went through medical school with my twin brother, and I realized after about a decade how much I'd lost the practice of medicine. So by default, I became a filmmaker at a time when I didn't think you could. There was no such thing as a career in Australia as a filmmaker, but I was just led to it out of a sense of inquiry, curiosity.
Did the things you saw in emergency rooms have anything to do with the Mad Max films, which are, of course, are about mayhem on the highways in some, in great respect?
The very first one definitely was about that. There was something about how we deal with violence in society and how we deal with it in the media that I was very interested in, I guess thematically, but interestingly enough, I was also interested in very kinetic cinema as I was trying to understand what this new language, which is not much more than 100 years old, let's say 120 years old now, the film language is, and it's very universal. It basically was formed in the silent era in the chase films of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and the two real westerns. And I really went back and looked at those. And I saw, this is in a sense cinema was forged. So I became very, very interested in the action movie. And those two things drove me. to make the first Mad Max in some way.
There's quite a car culture in rural Australia, isn't there?
Yes, we don't have a gun culture, but growing up in remote Australia, the car was the thing. Big expanses of landscape and long straight roads, and as soon as someone could get their hand on a car, I mean, like a lot of rural people were driving, you know, when they were kids already, not on the main roads, of course, but on country properties, and so I remember growing up there, and the car was I don't know, it was a way to get out of town. It was a way to express themselves in some way by doing up cars. It was something that really, really struck me. And then my brothers and I, my parents took us to the city, and I had an education where, you know, as I said, I ended up working in big city hospitals, and I saw the other side of it as well, the chaos of the vehicles, and, you know, when people were coming into emergencies with really bad injuries and so on. And so that sort of got to me in a way. And I think making the first Mad Max was a way of processing that.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with George Miller, who wrote and directed all four Mad Max films. The latest, Fury Road, has 10 Oscar nominations, including Best Director and Best Picture. After a break, they'll talk more about Mad Max and about Miller's film, Babe. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects during treatment. More about integrative cancer care is available at cancercenter.com. And from Island Records, with Elton John's Wonderful Crazy Night featuring Looking Up. The new studio album is written by Elton John and Bernie Taupin, with production from T-Bone Burnett. Now available at Amazon Music.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with George Miller, who directed all four Mad Max movies. Mad Max Fury Road, the latest in his post-apocalyptic series, is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. The film stars Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. The three previous Mad Max films starred Mel Gibson. George Miller also wrote the film Babe and directed the sequel, Babe, A Pig in the City, and he directed the animated film Happy Feet and its sequel, Happy Feet 2.
Well, you made the first Mad Max film in 1979. I thought we'd listen to some of the trailer of that film.
They've broken his wife. They've killed his best friend.
People don't believe in heroes anymore.
They've pushed him too far.
We're gonna give them back their heroes.
Mad Max. The last law in a world gone out of control. Where every day is a duel. Every life is on the line. And every turn in the road brings you face to face with a new kind of terror. Mad Max. Pray that he's out there. Somewhere.
And that is the trailer for Mad Max, directed in 1979 by our guest George Miller. Yeah, it takes you back to hear that?
Well, it's and makes me a little squeamish because the film was Australian, a very low-budget Australian film. Mm-hmm. And here in America, back in 1979, it was released by Samuel Ziakov from American International Pictures, which made the kind of Roger Corman-type movies. And they took all the Australian accents and and dubbed it with the American accent because the Australian accent back then... very few people had heard.
And American audiences couldn't understand what they were saying?
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I first came to America in the mid-70s, people were surprised that Australians spoke English. It wasn't too many years later, of course, that people got used to listening to Australian. But so when I listened to that, I thought, oh, that's a classic kind of, you know, first of all, AIP, Samuel Ziakov, exploitation movie making, which it was. But also when I hear some of the characters, indeed Mel Gibson, who was American, he was born in America, was dubbed. And there's an actor in it who plays the Immortan Joe in this movie. Hughes Byrne was from the Royal Shakespeare Company. And he ended up in Australia after touring a show. And when the film was released in Britain, they played the dubbed version, and all his friends from the Royal Shakespeare Company turned up to hear him speaking with a southern drawl, a southern American drawl. It was quite... So all that comes back to me when I hear that.
So when we... If you get the DVD of that in the United States, you're not hearing it the way it was originally spoken by the Australian actors, right?
Well, no. As far as I know, there was enough uproar about it that eventually the original version was released at some point on DVD, but I'm not too sure what exists out there.
Now, the first Mad Max film is not in a post-apocalyptic nuclear landscape. I mean, society still exists. He's a cop, kind of a hero, kind of a Western hero fighting bad guys out on the highways. But the bad guys are like these really creepy, sadistic guys, just utterly ruthless and cruel. Where did those characters come from? Were there people like that on the highways in Australia?
No. And unfortunately, I mean, there could be, but not as exaggerated as that. I mean, that story, I initially intended to make it contemporary. That was a very, very low-budget film, and it was the first film that I made with my partner, Byron Kennedy, and we'd made short films but had never really been on a movie set before. And it was very difficult. We could not afford, if it was a contemporary story, to block off busy streets and have other vehicles and pay location fees for expensive buildings and so on. So the solution was to go to the back streets, the empty back streets, and go to derelict buildings where we didn't have to populate it with anything but our key characters. And in order to make that convincing, and because the story was so hyperbolic that I just simply put the caption in front of it, a few years from now, to imply some dystopian world. And that came out of just simply working with the budget. It wasn't until we made the second film, Road Warrior, that I was suddenly aware that we had unwittingly tapped into a kind of archetype. The first film did extremely well all around the world, and it was recognized, for instance, in Japan. They saw Max as a kind of lone samurai, and the French critics picked up on it and called it a Western on wheels. And in Scandinavia, he was the lone Viking warrior wandering the wasteland. It seemed to have that sort of universal resonance, and that's when the second film became much more consciously mythological in that sense.
When you cast Mel Gibson in the original Mad Max, he was a relatively unknown actor, right? What did you see in him that was right for that role?
Well, he was just out of the National Drama School. He and Geoffrey Rush and Judy Davis were all in the same class, and they were very, very traditional theatre education, basically, because there wasn't really much TV, and certainly there weren't many movies being made at all. And he was 21 when he made the first Mad Max. And all I know is that when we were casting, there was something about him when he walked through the door, but when I saw him perform in the video tests, there was something about it that was very, very convincing. And I really didn't know much about acting, but I was very interested to see what this actor would do next.
We're speaking with George Miller. His new film, Mad Max Fury Road, is nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization offering educational adventures for adults in 150 countries, including six-week language and cultural immersion programs in Europe and South America at roadscholar.org. And from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed with email marketing, working to help organizations meet their goals through personalized marketing help via phone, seminars, and webinars. More at constantcontact.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with film director George Miller. He made the Mad Max movies. The latest, Mad Max Fury Road, is nominated for Best Picture. I want to talk about another film of yours. This is one that you wrote but did not direct, the adorable film Babe, where animals are talking. It's about the pig who becomes an award-winning sheep herder. In this clip, this is the beginning of the film. When this little pig has arrived at the farm, all the animals can talk, and what we hear is a mother sheepdog talking to her puppies about the pig and briefly with the pig and with a comment thrown in from a horse. Let's listen.
That looks stupid, Mom.
Not as stupid as sheep, mind you, but pigs are definitely stupid.
Excuse me. No, we're not.
Good heavens. Who are you?
I'm a large white.
Yes, that's your breed, dear. What's your name?
I don't know.
Well, what did your mother call you to tell you apart from your brothers and sisters?
Our mom called us all the same.
And what was that, dear?
She called us all babe.
Perhaps we shouldn't talk too much about family.
I want my mom.
And that's from the film Babe, which was written and produced by our guest, George Miller. So George Miller, you have the Mad Max films, in which the villains are these just ruthless, cruel, sadistic people. And then we have Babe, and then Babe 2, Pig in the City, which you directed, and Happy Feet, the terrific movie about the penguin who can't sing but can dance. Is there a connection here?
Well, there is. People do look at me weirdly. Even my mother said, you know, when you started making the Babes and Happy Feet, I thought you were calming down in some way. But when she saw the latest Fury Road, she said, I sometimes wonder what goes on in your head. But there is a logic. I said earlier that I really was aware that the Mad Max stories were a kind of corruption of the hero myth. And, you know, we all know the great work that Joseph Campbell did studying comparative religion and folklore and so on. And basically, huge scholarship there, which has influenced movies and the classic hero myth. Now, what was interesting is that I happened to hear somebody reviewing a book written by a pig farmer, Dick King Smith, in England, called The Sheep Pig. And the way this was someone on the BBC radio, and as she was reviewing this book, she started to laugh. And laugh in a way that it obviously really got to her. So I immediately went and bought the book and read it and recognized that indeed this was a classic Joseph Campbell hero myth. By relinquishing self-interest, the heroic character basically is the agent of change and bestows some boon on the world and in a way changes it. But it's a very, very small story. It's not something that could be done as an animation, and it's not kinetic and flamboyant in the way that you could do cell animation, which is the only way people were doing animation back then. So it was a question of waiting to see whether or not the technology was available to actually make the animals talk. And that took about, you know, this was still an analog era, and it took about 5-6 years, and the film was shot at Universal just at the time when Steven Spielberg was doing Jurassic Park, and that same technology was basically used. It was early to mid 90s, and it was the beginning of that, this, you know, the biggest shift, I believe, since sound, the digital era. Anyway, the point being is that there is that connection.
You know, I read that when you were discussing the success of that film. You said that you can never tell why a film works until 10 years later. You still think that? You get more of a sense?
Yes, I think you make a film, if you do it properly, you're putting all of yourself into it. Everything you know and whatever wisdoms and skills you might have accumulated along the way. But you don't really know how it's going to impact. And It usually takes time. First of all, people write about it in reviews, and there tends to be a consensus of what works and what doesn't over time. And then people somehow, to some extent, a film either impinges in some way on a culture or it doesn't. And after a while, the audience starts to tell you what your film is. I think that's accelerating in some way. It happened very, very quickly on Fury Road. I mean, on the surface, it's an action movie, but there's a lot of stuff that people are picking up along the way. And this film came out almost a year ago, and because the reviews tended to be very full-hearted, and so people wrote incisively about the film and talked incisively about the film. So that's gone a little bit more quickly, but I don't know. It'll be a few years before I or anyone else will have any idea as to whether the film really stuck, as it were. And you know, I'm quite taken aback when people stop me now and then and show me the tattoos that they have of characters from particularly the Mad Max movies, and particularly from Fury Road, because I'm thinking, oh, the tattoos are permanent, and I hope the film sort of endures in some way so that they don't have to get them removed so painfully later on.
Yeah, I've read that. You see people with tattoos from characters from this film. What's your reaction when you say that?
I'm very
permanently marked their body. So they're so moved by your film.
It's an astonishing thing to see, because something that you've played around with in your mind, and then you made some representation of that, and then people are responding to it in a way that you never expected. You know, I was in Japan and I was being interviewed much like this by a a Japanese radio interviewer, and he talked about Fury Road in a way that I thought, wow, that, you know, he got down deep into the subtext and all its resonances and so on about, you know, the contemporary world and the past and history and so on. And I said, did you get all that from one screening? And he said, no. I walked out and then I asked to see the movie again, a second time, almost immediately. And I said, wow, gee, that's very, you know, very impressive. And then he took me aside and he opened up his shirt, and on his chest he had tattooed the logo of the Immortan. He brands everybody with his logo.
The cruel warlord, yeah.
Yeah, the cruel warlord, the Immortan Joe. And I thought, boy, that was a pretty humbling thing to see. And it meant enough to him to do that. And, you know, often I realized at some point that all stories should have a little health warning, you know, hazardous material. There is a responsibility to storytelling, and particularly the darker stories. You know, if a story does have some impact in a culture.
Well, George Miller, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
George Miller directed the 4 Mad Max movies, including the latest, Fury Road, which is nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. After a short break, rock historian Ed Ward will profile bandleader Dan Hicks. He died Saturday at the age of 74. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember Dan Hicks, who died of liver cancer Saturday. He was 74. He was a singer, songwriter, and leader of the band Dan Hicks and His Hot Licks, which he formed in the late 1960s in San Francisco. His music, an acoustic mix of folk, jazz, and swing, with modern, quirky lyrics, was out of step with the rock bands of the time. But our rock historian Ed Ward says Hicks was so far behind the times, he was ahead of them. We're going to listen back to a piece Ed recorded about Hicks in 2002 after the release of the album The Most of Dan Hicks and His Hot Licks, which collected previously unreleased demos along with tracks from the band's first album.
By 1969, Dan Hicks was already a San Francisco scene veteran. He'd been the drummer and later a guitarist with the first of the psychedelic bands there, the Charlatans, who specialized in Wild West attire and electric folk rock, but got passed over when the recording gold rush came to town. But Hicks had another vision, one that was to put him completely at odds with what America expected from the city of the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead.
I've talked to your mother and I've talked to your dad. They say they've tried, but it's all in vain. I've begged and I've pleaded, I've even got mad. Now we must face it, you give me a pain. How can I miss you when you won't go away? Keep telling you day after day, but you won't listen, you always stay and stay. How can I miss you when you won't go away? You're never in.
Quitting the Charlatans, he cast around the city for acoustic musicians. Instead of a lead guitar, he wanted a violin and recruited David LaFlame for that job, but lost him when LaFlame started his own band, It's a Beautiful Day. Hicks wanted call and response with a couple of girl singers and found Tina Gantcher and Sherry Snow. The band was delayed while their bassist, Jamie Leopold, did a few months for selling pot. But when he came back, he brought along his guitar-playing roommate, John Weber, and the Hot Licks were almost there. With the recording deadline looming, Hicks took his mother to a cocktail lounge for her birthday and heard Sid Page playing violin. That was it.
Baby, you sure are looking good tonight.
Thanks, handsome.
I sure do like your style. All the while.
She's a bit all tiny, but that's all right with me. She wears a dress of velvet that hangs below her knees, her knees. She.
While his peers were delving deeper into electric blues and hard rock, Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks were exploring swing, and their first album, Original Recordings, baffled nearly everyone who heard it. Nonetheless, Epic Records called them back to do a second one, produced by blues scholar Pete Welding, but it was never finished or released. Still, it had made an impression on some people, and in late 1970, Tommy LaPuma, who was a partner in a new record label called Blue Thumb, signed the latest edition of the Hot Licks to the label and set them up in the Troubadour, an L.A. nightclub, for 5 days and recorded them live.
This is a little exercise in control, this next tune. You probably think it's easy being up here singing and everything and playing. It's not. It's not easy. Thank you.
It was the right decision. In the couple of years since their debut, the Hot Licks, and fiddler Sid Page in particular, had gotten hotter. Naomi Ruth Eisenberg and Mary Ann Price were far more accomplished vocalists than the previous girl singers had been, and John Weber was gone.
This expresses our feeling, ladies and gentlemen. It's called I Feel Like Singing. There are people who live for the moment,
the moment,
the moment,
the moment,
and others who don't seem to get much enjoyment,
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 enjoyment.
Some are always glad, others always sad, but lately,
lately,
seems that I've been
somewhere in between.
It's a funny feeling,
love is what I mean. Yes, I'm so in love, can't tell down from up above, down, down, down from up above.
I feel like singing. I feel like singing.
The resulting album, Where's the Money, flopped, rising only as high as 195 on the Hot 200. Undeterred, LaPuma put the band in the studio and tried again, this time with a hot lead acoustic guitarist for Page to interact with, John Gerton.
Some folks think it's cool to have some kind of lover. Cause he just found another. And when they see him, they might see him on the street. He walks with rhythm, so he's got some kind of beat.
He clicks his heels a bit, his suit's a perfect fit.
He knocks him out,
though he looks alone.
Somebody
wants him on the phone.
Shout,
they won't shout.
He's walking one and only, and they're calling him by name. He won't be leaving town till he can count some fame.
Striking It Rich, the second album, was a masterpiece. Marianne Price's sardonic reading of Johnny Mercer's I'm an Old Cowhand became a number so identified with her that she still performs it today. And they re-recorded a couple of numbers from the early days, Canned Music and I Scare Myself, and brought them to perfection, particularly the latter tune, where Sid Page spent 2 minutes and 47 seconds fiddling himself into history.
Thank you.
second Blue Thumb album did no better than the first, but the band toured, and they went in for a third try. This time, it showed signs of life, rising to number 67 on the charts. As always, there was life in the grooves, too.
I'm standing on a corner with the feet in my shoes, racking my brain out to pay my dues. My jug's empty of my number one booze, long comes a viper and I blow my blues.
I got the elation, hesitation, dissipation, coagulation, relation, anxiety, emancipation, propagation, mop, talk, talk, a bunch of coffee, blues. It's never too late to be up today, you can get it now, but you have to wait.
Well, I'm coming, chick, come a little dolly, she's out walking a
big fat collie.
Miss Marta says,
you look about it, jolly.
There ain't none left, but I'm ready, my sally.
I got the outer space, water race, drop an ace in my face, a goose chase, a water taste, match, stretch, stretch, catch, blue.
Maybe it was a joke calling it Last Train to Hicksville, the home of Happy Feet, but that's what it turned out to be. One day in 1973, Dan just broke up the band, and that was that. One of America's best bands disappeared before most people had had a chance to hear them. He finally got another album out in 2000 with guest appearances by Ricky Lee Jones, Bette Midler, Elvis Costello, and Tom Waits, among others, and Sid back on the violin.
Ed Ward recorded that profile of Dan Hicks in 2002. Hicks died Saturday of liver cancer. He was 74.
Welcome and bienvenue. Welcome.
Tomorrow, my guest will be Joel Grey. He originated the role of the decadent MC in the 1967 Broadway production of Cabaret and co-starred in Chicago and Wicked. He's written a new memoir about his career and about being gay and closeted. He fell in love with an actress, they raised two children, and then divorced. Only recently did he publicly come out. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Home Instead Senior Care, providing an individualized approach designed to meet a family's needs, offering a range of in-home care services from help around the house to Alzheimer's care to keep aging loved ones at home. HomeInstead.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at WTGrantFoundation.org.